Because they needed me, I didn't see it at first, the way dementia was creeping in around the edges of my dad's mind. He'd always been sharp, stubborn, a man of rules and routines who could plan a drive to Cyprus in his sleep. But those unsettling flickers of confusion started to show. He'd ask the same question over and over, forget things, and then fiercely deny forgetting at all. One thing really brought it home, that company van. Technically, it was Pistachio's lease. With the bankruptcy, the company was dead. The van wasn't mine. I was supposed to give it back. But I clung to it like the last scrap of dignity I had. My freedom, even if it was borrowed. My dad obsessed over it, every single day. Have you given that van back yet? I'd shrug, dodge, try to change the subject. He'd get angry. They'll stop you, Asen. Take it away on the road. Leave you there like an idiot with no car, no way home. I won't have it. We went round and round like that, wearing each other out. And then, while I was away in Corfu, he did something no one expected. Corfu. Jesus. Don and Alan practically dragged me there. I didn't want the sun, didn't want the company. I'd have rather stayed in bed, staring at the ceiling, letting the misery drown me. But Don and Alan wouldn't let me. Just 4 days, mate. Wednesday to Saturday. You need this. Nikos will look after us. And Nikos did. Don's old mate from those chefing summers, the kind of man who made you feel welcome the second you arrived. He and his brothers were grafters. Bars, apartments, a little breakfast spot. They fed us, poured us drinks, let me forget who I was for a few hours. For 4 days I laughed, really laughed, and for that I'll always owe Don and Alan. But the second I landed back in England, reality snapped shut. My dad, the man who couldn't send a text, who thought email was some kind of witchcraft, had somehow discovered Facebook Marketplace. And not just discovered it. He'd bought a car. Not just any car. A bloody Range Rover Sport. His dream machine. When I asked why, he shrugged with that stubborn glint in his eye. I've always wanted one, he said. I let him have that. But here's the truth. He hadn't bought it for himself. He was waiting for me when I walked in. Come on, he said, grabbing his coat. We're going to Tottenham. I tried to talk him out of it. He wouldn't hear a word. We drove up there, him jittery with excitement, looking over that car like a kid in a toy shop. Didn't even test drive it, just handed over the money. But when we got it home, he turned to me, eyes shining. It's yours, he said. You're bankrupt. You can't get one in your name. This is mine. They can't touch it. Just give that bloody lease van back before they pull you over and humiliate you. That was my dad. Even as dementia nipped at his mind, he was crystal clear about one thing, protecting me. Even at 50, 26 stone, bankrupt and lost, I was still his boy. But it wasn't simple. I had read Take a Look at the Car, my old school mechanic in Grove Park I actually trusted. He kept it a few days, drove it himself, then he called me, voice low. Mate, it's a disaster. One morning all the diesel had just poured out onto the road. The seller had hidden split fuel lines with gaffer tape that melted as soon as the exhaust got hot. Underneath, wrecked, cracked manifold, shot EGR pipe, broken timing cover and belt, faulty inlet seals, leaking oil cooler, turbo gasket ruined, wheel bearing hub failing, even the electronic handbrake actuator was dead. Red didn't sugarcoat it. Body's gotta come off the chassis to fix half of this. Too expensive. Not worth it. Cut your losses. I thought about it. Seriously. But then I pictured my dad, sitting in that car on the drive, not even going anywhere. Just breathing in the smell of the leather, running his fingers over the dash, smiling like he was 20 again. I couldn't take that away from him. So I lied, told him I was just getting the handbrake fixed, never mentioned the rest. I sent it to Sparrowhawk Motors in Chelsea, nearly £7,400 in repairs. Every line of that invoice burned into my brain, but worth every penny, because when it was done, I watched him climb in next to me, grinning. For that moment alone, it was all okay. But I worried, about the receiver, about anyone sniffing around for my assets. I knew there was money in Pitpuck's account, and even though I wasn't a director, it was the parent company of the franchise cafes. If the claimant's solicitors got wind, they'd twist it any way they liked. So I went to Josh. Careful, quiet, he didn't even blink, just said, yeah, we'll sort it. That was that. Life kept turning. During the split from Diane, I'll admit it, I sent her messages I probably shouldn't have. Apologies, offers to stay friends. Hoping for what? Even I didn't know. Some last scrap of warmth. some proof she still cared. She never replied. No idle chit-chat. Only twice did I hear from her directly. Once to arrange collecting my things, my clothes, my B&O system with the speakers, but not the massive red line ones in the loft that I loved. My backgammon set, my chess set. Small things, but they felt big, because there was so much more up in that loft. More than just boxes gathering dust. It was a vault of my life. Wedding presents from the day I married Sally. Delicate Colport china still wrapped in tissue, never used, too heavy with meaning to let go. Old videotapes, grainy with age, of the kids when they were little. Birthday cakes, squealing seaside trips, Christmas mornings that felt endless. And in that stack was the most fragile relic of all, a personal video from Sally. Her voice, warm and familiar, her eyes on mine, her smile. I hadn't dared watch it in years, terrified of what it might break open inside me. There were too many boxes, too many layers of memory. I couldn't just haul them away in one trip. I'd have to go back to Eastbourne, pick them up carefully, decide what I could carry, what I could let go, how to shoulder all that precious cargo of memory without letting it bury me for good. And then there was the funding circle fiasco. When Nelson bought the lease off us, really we should have cleared the funding circle loan. We'd use that money to finance the Red Lion Square kiosk. But instead, the three of us, Diane, Adrian, and I, decided to keep the loan going through Pistachios. For years, it was Diane who covered it, month after month, without a single complaint. But after the bankruptcy, there was no Pistachios left to take the hit. She and I were both guarantors. She denied knowing anything. Told Funding Circle she'd never signed a thing. She told them I'd forged her signature, branded me a fraudster, said I'd done to her exactly what the High Court had already convicted me of. She was desperate, and she was willing to throw me under the bus to save herself. They sent a letter, dry, polite, but terrifying, said if it was true, it was criminal fraud. Possibly prison. I called them immediately, heart thudding in my chest. They listened. Really listened. Told me they didn't buy her story. Their expert had reviewed the signatures. Each one actually signed, with all the subtle variations you'd expect. For over 4 years she'd paid it. Responded to emails. But she gambled on one thing. That I'd already been branded fraudster in civil court. That they might see that word and think, maybe he did it. She was counting on that label sticking. For £8,000, she was willing to see me go to prison. The same woman who once cried for her ex when he went to jail. Was it always about the money? I didn't know anymore. In the end, I spoke to Amy Cox at Funding Circle. She treated me like a human being. I explained everything. Told her I'd pay if they'd lower the figure. Diane owed over £10,000 with interest. After some back and forth, we settled on £7,500. Amy sent the email confirming it. I went to Josh. Careful. Quiet. He didn't even blink. Just said, yeah, we'll pay it. Debt gone. No thanks from Diane. No apology. Just curt emails from Theo asking if it was paid, demanding records. At least that nightmare was over. Meanwhile, life at my mom and dad's had its own strange rhythm. Comforting. Sad. My dad had this daily ritual. Off to the local Turkish supermarket to stock up on halloumi fruit, especially watermelon when it was in season bread, then on to Tesco for the rest. He didn't really need to go every day, but he did. I think he needed the illusion of purpose. Needed to see people. Pretend things were normal. My mom was struggling more. The stairs had become an impossible mountain. The council installed a stair lift, thank God. They even approved funding for a walk-in shower, but the wait was endless. Worse, the fitters insisted they couldn't do it flush to the floor because the waste pipe didn't drop enough. There'd have to be a step. I remember telling Josh one night, angry and frustrated. He snorted, "That's rubbish. You just drop the waste pipe at the stack. Cut the joists. Fiddly, sure, but doable." He didn't hesitate, offered to do it himself for the cost of parts. A few weeks later, they had their shower. Floor-level tray, grab rails, disabled chair. Finally, they could wash in safety with dignity. Life got a bit easier. But my dad's dementia was showing its teeth more and more. He'd have these angry little lapses, barking, "I'm fine," if you even hinted at it. His voice sharp, his eyes wet with pride and fear. And what could we do? We pretended right along with him. But the truth was inescapable. It all came to a head one night. The night I tried to use that comedy and dinner voucher Diane had given me months before. For ages it had sat there, mocking me. Finally, I thought, why not? I asked Raimi if he wanted to come. He didn't even hesitate. That day I did my usual swim at David Lloyd's. The water, the only place my ruined hips and knees didn't scream at me. Later I drove to Raimi's, picked him up, and we headed into Covent Garden. We found the restaurant. Sleek little spot. Pan-Asian menu. We ordered, watching the time, knowing the comedy show was downstairs at 9. But while I was trying to stitch together some normality, everything was falling apart back at my parents' place. Earlier that day, Mum had gone into the ensuite bathroom. Passed out. Cracked her head as she fell. My dad heard the crash and sprinted upstairs. She didn't stay unconscious long, but when she came round, she couldn't move. Said her legs and back hurt too much. He called 999. The paramedics came quickly. Told him they had to take her to North Middlesex. He said he'd follow. But it wasn't normal anymore. He used to be able to drive anywhere. London, the UK, Europe, even to Cyprus. But that night, he got lost. I didn't know any of this yet when my phone rang around 8:30 p.m. It was Dad. He didn't mention Mum. Didn't say anything about the hospital. Instead, he told me, small and bewildered, that he was outside his own front door. The key had snapped in the lock. He was locked out. He needed help. I looked at Remy. Told him we'd have to skip the comedy. He didn't even blink. Of course, he said. We drove straight there. Got to Dad's around 10. The key was jammed in the lock, broken off. Luckily, one of the upstairs windows was ajar. Dad had the key to the garage, where he kept the big extendable ladders. Remy climbed up, swung his leg over the sill, and let us in. I called a 24-hour locksmith. When it was finally quiet, I sat my dad down, asked him gently, where was Mum? Why had he been out so late? He looked at me with cloudy eyes, said he'd tried to follow the ambulance, but he'd got turned around. Couldn't find the hospital, just kept driving. Somehow, hours later, he'd found his way back home. He didn't even know how. That's when it really hit me. His dementia was getting worse. The man who once knew every turn, every road, every crossing, all the way to Cyprus was now lost in his own city. And Mum was alone in hospital. I sat there in the dim hallway, heartbreaking, realizing the roles had truly reversed. Even at 63, 26 stone, bankrupt and lost, I was still his boy. And he was slipping away. And I was the one who had to try to keep us all afloat. After a battery of tests at the hospital, the doctors finally sat us down. Their voices were calm, measured, like they'd delivered news like this 1,000 times before. It's her blood pressure, they said. It's too low. Those words just hovered in the cold, sterile hospital air. The monitors in the next bay kept up their indifferent beeping. Low blood pressure. It sounded so minor, so harmless. But they explained it wasn't. They already knew about the pacemaker in her chest. That tiny metal guardian ticking away to keep her heart from stalling. But even that wasn't enough to save her from this. They described it in those plain, clinical words that strip the comfort from everything. How the brain is greedy for blood, for oxygen. How it needs a constant, steady flow to stay awake, alive. And if blood pressure drops too low? There isn't enough force, the doctor said, pressing his fingers together, showing how weak it was. Not enough push to get the blood up to the brain. He paused, letting the silence hang like a verdict. So the brain does the only thing it can to protect itself. It makes you collapse. Faint. Black out. Crash to the floor. So you're lying down, he added, softer now, almost apologetic. That way the heart doesn't have to fight gravity. The blood can get where it needs to go. It's the body's last-ditch safety valve. I sat there, listening to this man in his white coat, trying to sound reassuring, trying to keep my own face from crumpling, trying to be the strong one, because that's what sons are supposed to do. All the while, I was picturing her lying there on that cold bathroom floor, my dad standing over her, helpless, frightened. And then they told us something else. She was dehydrated, too. They'd seen it straight away, her veins sluggish, her skin papery and cool. They'd hooked her to a drip, watched the color return to her face, the life creep back into her voice. Finally, once they were sure she was stable, they said she could go home. But it wasn't as simple as just sending her away and hoping for the best. Now that they knew what was causing the blackouts, she needed medication to keep her blood pressure steady. They'd write to her GP so her blister pack of daily pills could be reviewed, adjusted, added to. I nodded like I understood, pretending it was all so straightforward. But inside, something buckled. Because this was our new normal. A life of managing it, watching for the warning signs, hoping she didn't fall again. And that was what cut deepest. Knowing that the strongest woman I'd ever known, my mother, was now at the mercy of something as invisible, as treacherous, as her own blood pressure. And it hit me harder than I expected. I had to move in with them. They needed help, even if they were too proud to ask for it. My dad would never come out and say the words. But every day he'd call me, asking where I was, telling me how much he missed me. It was his way of asking without asking, of saying he didn't want to be alone in this, but he couldn't bring himself to say, "Stay, help us." That pride was bone deep, and I had to see past it. Because the truth was, I'd been too wrapped up in myself, feeling sorry for myself, beating myself up over everything I'd lost, every asset I'd built up over 40 years of graft, all gone, bankrupt, ruined, feeling like the biggest failure imaginable. But none of that mattered now. It was time to brush that self-pity aside, because they needed me. My mom, too frail to even stand at the cooker anymore. My dad, still shuffling around on his feet, still trying to keep up the routines that had defined his life. Daily trips to the local Turkish supermarket for halloumi, fruit, bread, then on to Tesco. He didn't even need half of it. He just needed the illusion of purpose. Needed to see people, to pretend things were normal. He used to garden so proudly, tomatoes and cucumbers in his tiny plot. A pergola he'd built himself, trained with grapevines so my mom could pick the leaves to make dolma. 3 fig trees and an apricot tree he'd nurtured for years. When the great-grandchildren visited, it must have seemed like a forest to them in their little statures. But now? Now the trees were overgrown, the vines ran wild into the neighbors' gardens, creeping over their garage roof. My dad couldn't manage it anymore, and he was too proud to ask for help. Paying someone to garden, or even to clean the house? That was unthinkable. And my mom, she just didn't have the strength anymore. Inside, life was no easier. She couldn't stand to cook. He couldn't cook at all. He never had to learn. Why would he, when she'd always been such an incredible cook, laying out meals that brought the family together? The garden was left to grow wild and unruly, the vines tangling unchecked. The front hedge had shot up over 10 feet, thick and unmanageable, making trimming it with a hedge trimmer not just difficult, but downright dangerous. Meals were reduced to kebab takeaways, fish and chips from the same shop, or McDonald's. That was the life they'd built. But that life was slipping away now. And so I made up my mind. I still had my place in Sidcup, but the truth is I was hardly there. More often than not, I was at Mum and Dad's. I'd all but moved in, because they needed someone. Not just to make tea or sweep the floors, but to keep watch. To be there if they stumbled. To stop the house from crumbling around them. And despite everything, despite being 50, over 26 stone, bankrupt, and lost, I was still their son. This was the one thing I could still do right.